Thank you, Oleg. So as the title suggests, I would like to raise a problem that might have this chance that strengthens the Kepler conjecture. And in order to motivate that, before I state a question, probably it's a good idea if I explain the origin of it. So this is a paper here from 2000, but actually the result that is discussed here goes back to a well-known theorem of Rogers and Baranowski. We have heard about this in some previous talks. Pictorially, what we are after here is the following. We have a packing of congruent balls, say of unit balls in d-dimensional Euclidean space. So the radii are equal to 1. Let's simplify methods. And each ball is centered at some point. So this is a typical ball in the packing. And each ball naturally give rise to a Voronoi cell. So there is a Voronoi cell associated with each ball. And as we all know, that's a polyhedral thing. It consists of points that are not farther away from the given unit ball than from any others. And because of this, it is always an intersection of closed half spaces. So the set that we get as a Voronoi cell in case of a packing is always a convex polyhedral set, not necessarily bounded, but when the packing is dense, saturated, then each cell is in fact a bounded convex polyhedral set, or in short, a convex polyhedron. And now the theorem actually, let me use a notation here because that's used over there. Let's label the volume of these unit balls in D space by omega D. And the theorem actually claims that the volume, the D-dimensional volume of any Voronoi cell is always at least as large as omega D divided by number, specific number, which is the Rogers-Baranowski bound, and the pictorial is easy to define what it means. So sigma of D here is generated as follows. You take a regular simplex of edge lengths 2 in D space, and then you draw unit balls around the corners of this simplex, and that way you generate sectors. So each unit ball intersects the regular simplex in a sector. That these sectors, they are D plus one of them, have some volume. You add them and divide that by the volume of the regular simplex. This is a number strictly less than 1, and this is what we label by sigma of D. So it's the fraction of two quantities. You sum up the volumes of these sectors. I don't want to introduce notation here, and divide it by the volume of the regular simplex. So this is sigma of D.
Two independent papers.
And Baranowski. Yeah. I forgot, but you probably know better than me. Which year? But that's mentioned in the paper somewhere. So if you look it up, that's there. So this is known. Now what, this is their theorem here. And then this theorem that is contained in this paper is very much an analog of this, except here we replace volume by surface volume. So in this paper, it is proved that the surface volume of any Voronoi cell in a packing of unit balls is at least D times omega D over sigma of D. Okay? So The difference lies in the following, that we, instead of estimating volume of Voronoi cells, we estimate surface volume of Voronoi cells. And this inequality is proved. The sigma of these exact same thing what I said over there. This up in the numerator is the surface volume of a unit sphere. So this quantity is also natural to have. Yeah? Sigma D is a ratio of volumes. Yeah, yes. And here, however, there is this D in the numerator. So for that reason, this it actually implies the theorem. So from here, you can get the Rogers-Baranowski theorem. So putting it differently, if we estimate surface volume in an efficient way, we can squeeze out good density bounds. And indeed, this is what happened here, that also in dimension 3, I computed this number. So in dimension 3, there was this lower bound for the surface area of Voronoi cells. And also, this conjecture was put forward as a strong dodecahedral conjecture that in 3 space, if you pack 3 space by unit poles, then the surface area of any Voronoi cell is at least as large as the surface area of a regular dodecahedron circumscribed by unit pole. So this conjecture was mentioned there in this paper. And and then further developments happened here, and I want to mention them very briefly. This paper is extending or strengthening this result for higher dimensional spaces. And roughly speaking, what happens there is this, that one can come up with a better lower bound. This, I'm under time pressure, probably I just write this way, put a hat here in the numerator, and say formally, very briefly, this, that this could be well defined, but this is this turns out to be strictly smaller than this numerator here, and pictorially one could just simply say that this is obtained, this quantity here is obtained the same fashion as this one, except I cut off some parts of these balls, so actually when we add these volumes together we get smaller number. So this is for all dimensions smaller than this. In other words, when you use this for estimating surface, for estimating density of unit balls, you get better bounds than the Rogers bound. And in fact, up to dimension 42, this was the best for a time being. And then Cohn, Elkius, and no. Cohn and Elkius. Kabatinsky-Leverstein is better in dimension 42 and higher. Okay, even if you use this, this turns out to be less strong, weaker than the Kabatinsky-Leverstein bound in dimension 42 and higher. But over the interval up to 42, and this was for the time being the best, and then Cohn and Elkius improved it up to dimension 32, but I believe also over the dimension 32, 42, their approach should be better than mine. On the other hand, really here the emphasis are on surface volume. So let me continue. Well, yeah. Yeah. I take a ratio, yeah. So it's you're right. This way it's a bit confusing and perhaps also misleading. But because I don't want to go into details, I really have just to say this, that, well, indeed this is very different from volume, because this is surface volume, and one has to really concentrate on understanding the geometry of the boundaries of Voronoi cells. So it's not really about the volume, about the entire geometric structure of the Voronoi cells. And in fact, as it turns out, in high dimensions, not the entire boundary of the Voronoi cell is responsible for this behavior of the inequality, only lower dimensional skeleta. So I really go after lower dimensional skeleta there, not really the co-dimension one faces, the facets in the proof. So this is one direction, but I also have to mention that all this applies to this interval only, and I have to really underline 8 here. There is a geometric reason why all this technology is applying only to sufficiently high dimensions. But it is interesting that exactly in this dimension is still working, which is a very good candidate perhaps for solving the denser sphere packing problem in that particular dimension. And then, of course, in dimension 3, further developments happened. We could just a little bit improve the lower bound in dimension 3 in this paper, and then these guys really could improve it further significantly, the lower bound for the surface area of Voronoi cells in 3 dimensions. Well, still there was a substantial gap between their lower bound, which they proved in this paper, and this one. All these papers technically are very similar, so they use the same technology in more and more sophisticated way. And then really just recently, he's smiling. So what happened was that really very recently, the strong dodecahedral conjecture has been proved, and his second talk here in September was about announcing that proof. The proof is really not short. So it's a computer-assisted proof. Philosophically, it is well-structured and nice. It fits very well in the program which Tom has set up here. The detailed proof will appear in this book. It's about ready to go. When you go to archive, then you will find a brief description of his proof of the strong dodecahedral conjecture. So it's a completely happy ending story in that regard in dimension 3, that finally it has been proved that the smallest surface area of Voronoi cell for unit ball packings in dimension 3 is the surface area of the regular dodecahedron circumscribed the unit ball. So then after this, of course, for me it was particularly pleasant to bring up the actual question that I was thinking of for some time now. And so this is in the archive now, it's a short paper, but here I will just talk about the part which is perhaps more suitable for the talk. The question, the central question I put down in italics here. So what we want now, we want to partition Euclidean 3 space into convex cells such that we minimize average surface area. And each cell contains a unit ball. So it's not a requirement anymore to take Voronoi cells. See, we can take any tiling of 3 space into convex cells, each containing a unit ball. However, what we want to minimize average surface area. And we look for the proper tiling, proper shape of the tiles. Before I go on, perhaps just let's make a bit more precise what we mean on average surface area. That's encoded into this formula, which pictorially is relatively easy to describe. So we will deal with packings of unit balls because each tie has to contain a unit ball. Just as before, I use B sub I for the unit ball centered at O sub I, so this is a ball of a unit radius. And now these cells are not Voronoi cells anymore, but they are convex. So each cell is a convex polyhedron. Some of the unit balls maybe really are surrounded by smaller cells, some are bigger cells. Nevertheless, when we have such a system, we can always start with our coordinate system, favorite coordinate system, and generate big cubes of edge length L here. Here's edge length L. These are cubes positioned parallel to the coordinate axis of edge length L. This is the L here in here. We will let L go to infinity. And then we create two quantities here. We count the number of unit balls which lie entirely in our cube. So this I would take this also, but if I see something like this, then we don't take those unit balls or the others, which, yeah. Not necessarily congruent, but I also make some additional assumptions here, which goes under the normal tiling business. So each cell contains a unit ball. Moreover, the supremum of the diameters is finite, so it's, there is an upper bound on the diameters of the convex cells. These two conditions we have, and then we introduce average surface area in this way, that you take those unit balls which lie in this big cube. Each has some cell that contains that the chosen unit ball. You take that cell, intersect it with the unit cube, and compute the surface area. Why intersection here? Because it still can happen, as you see here, that the unit ball is in the cube, but the cell actually not, in which case we take the intersection and compute the surface volume of that intersection. Well, this is a boundary effect here which we have to deal with, and then I take the limit, and that's what I call average surface area. Now, if we accept this as a definition, reasonable definition, then we can make some comments, immediate comments. One is this, that, well, okay, let's try to estimate. If we cannot really solve completely, what is the best tiling into convex cells? Well, I try, well, yeah, okay. So then maybe, is it better? Okay. Yeah, it's fine with me. Yeah. So this is the theorem that I want to prove. It gives a lower bound for the average surface area of convex cells in three space. But maybe this is not the, well, I'm sure this is not the best, but maybe there is a chance to prove this thing here, which is a very natural conjecture to make, that actually the average surface area is always at least this large, where this comes from that particular regular rhombic dodecahedron, which are the Voronoi cells for the densest face-center cubic lattice packing of unit balls. So that's the highest possible density there. With the help of that arrangement, we get the highest possible density. But perhaps also for us, that delivers the best tiling. This is, of course, just speculation, so this is a problem here. Prove or disprove that the average surface area of the cells of a normal tiling in Euclidean 3 space is at least as this large. We will prove this, that it is at least that large. And why is this connected to Kepler? Because it does imply Kepler. So if someone can prove this, we'll get Kepler, another proof for Kepler conjecture. And the reason is encoded in these two lines. When you want to estimate the density of a packing of unit balls in three space, you go through a procedure very similar to this. You take a huge window through which you investigate your packing, add together the volumes of the unit balls lying in the big cube, and divide that by by the sum of the volumes of the cells which are associated with those unit balls, again something like this happens. So that's why I'm writing out the intersection volumes here. So I don't really get the entire the volume of the big cube, something less, but never. This is a natural way of doing it, and then you upper bound this in the following fashion. It's written out there that since each cell contains a unit ball, therefore the volume the volume of the cell actually is at least as large as one cell times the surface area. Yeah, you just, when you have such a thing that a convex polyhedron and a unit ball somewhere inside, then you can generate these cones sitting over the faces, and the volume of each cone is surface area of the base times one third times the height, but the height is at least one. So the volume of the entire cell is at least one third times the surface area. That's what we are using there. And so in the denominator, we could make it smaller, the sum in the denominator, and write this there. But then this one third disappears, and this remains, and then this is just the convenient moment to bring in the average surface area that we introduced on the previous page. So in short, what I'm saying that is this, that if someone can prove this, that the average surface area of any normal tiling is at least this large, that implies the Kepler conjecture. And then perhaps also additional remark I want to make, because it was so tempting right after this to get rid of the convexity condition. What happens if we do not require that the cells are convex? We just shoot for the best form. This is called form because forms are simply tilings of space with possible small surface area. Yes. So if I drop the convexity condition, this becomes a form question. And of course, so when I got to this, I wrote to Frank Morgan because he's the source of major progress on Kelvin problem and related issue. In Kelvin's question, you in his form question, you tie space into volume one cells, and the goal there is to minimize surface area, average surface volume. In this case here, we tie space into cells containing a unit ball. With the same goal, we want to minimize average surface volume. And the surprise here is that with the machinery that is available for investigating forms, the best that was possible to get, you see here pictorially, and this I really have to thank to these people. And there's the surface area here is 16.95. So I just go 16.95 here, and then we go back to here. This is 16.97, two digits digit improvement in the hundreds only. So this means that we are hitting here something at present which is very unusual. Without convexity, it doesn't look much easier to actually get a better form than the very regular one which we get by tiling space into rhombic dodecahedra. If so, if indeed this is the nature of this problem, then somehow the denser sphere packing problem is almost the same as this Kelvin type-ish question that I raised when you tie space into cells such that each cell contains a unit ball and the goal is to minimize average surface volume. But this, as I said, unfortunately, this is a direction which so far is just started 3-4 weeks ago. And of course, also here it would be highly interesting to extend, which I have claimed, at least a lower bound, good lower bound, to find, but it's not yet there. So I'm not really going after this here in this talk, but surely there's a lot here that would be highly interesting to discuss and further progress. Nevertheless, what I'm trying to say, yeah. You know, this was actually along those lines, an attempt, because yeah, it's like I said, no substantial attempt, but attempts have been made. Yeah, yeah. It has verse average surface area. Yeah, it was, you know, that is a very natural thing, because the body-centered cubic lattice has been used by Kelvin. Kelvin form was created from the body-centered cubic lattice. He had this really ingenious idea, which also reflected here in this construction. This is an improvement here for this problem, obtained from Kelvin, and so it is obtained in implicit way from the body-centered cubic. So there are only two flat pieces here, this, and all the others are curvy, all the other faces, which is natural because in this case no convexity assumption is there. But indeed it is a very good point that you mentioned, that yeah, body-centered cubic lattice was an important thing to start with, because that was a suspicion that maybe that is better, but unfortunately not. Or lucky or not, I don't know. So back to this here. Since I don't know too much anything else to tell about the form question, I'd rather return to this condition where convexity enters here. Cells are convex, and we look at normal tilings. Each tile contains a uniball. How small the average surface area can be. So that lower bound. And the proof, I in the remaining time, I do want to discuss proof of this, because it is here based on an old paper of Curtis. And just like here, when this improvement was created based on earlier attempts on estimating volume, also here the idea of the proof is built on something which was created for estimating density, in other words, estimating volume of Voronoi cells for unit ball packings. There was an extra condition which totally separable unit ball packings have been investigated in that paper of Curtis, which we don't have here as a condition, so that differs, but the overall idea goes back to that paper. The proof consists of two parts. The second part is more technical than the first one, so I will just talk about the first one here, because it's technically much neater and more compact to get through. And the second part I omit. So this first part actually is about the following compact version of the theorem that we want to show. So we pick a cube. It is labeled by C. It's a bit like this cube which we have used for the definition of average surface volume, except now we know that it is tied into convex cells, each containing a unit ball. So in this case, we do not have situations like this where there would be a cell sticking out, having a unit ball not lying in the cube. So the situation here is very much ideal. The cube that we have is tiled into convex cells. Thank you. And each convex cell contains a unit ball. Yeah. So we have this nice tiling given to us, BI, PI, or QI. So the cells now are labeled by QIs. Each contains a unit ball, and we get a complete tiling of the cube C. And then we want to estimate the total surface area from below. Small n is the number of cells here. So the claim is that the total surface area is at least 24 over square root of 3 times n. What I will do, of course, we'll generate a sphere packing bound just as before, but that is, will not be interesting. It will be a weak one. But nevertheless, that connection is still there. So how do we do this? We first look at individual convex cells. So we just pick one cell in our system and try to understand some behavior of that cell. The central thing is just this inequality to get to. In this last row, you see an inequality which I want to explain how to derive. And it really involves this quantity which is goes under edge curvature. So when I have a convex polyhedron in free space, oh, thank you very much, I really should have done a better job here before, but okay. So there is an edge here, which each convex polyhedron has some edges. We just pick a typical edge. It has some length. So in the formula of the edge curvature, we sum up over all edges of the given convex polyhedron, and each term is a product of two things, length of the edge, and then a tangent of an angle. And so sorry. Yeah. So this is an orthonormal vector here. The other face behind has an orthonormal vector, and the angle between that is labeled by alpha sub e. So two faces meet along that edge. Each has an orthonormal vector, and the angle between the orthonormal vectors is traditionally involved into the definition of the edge curvature. So we take this angle and half of it, and the tangent of that is the term. Now, this is called an edge curvature, and it is an older sort of well-studied quantity assigned to a convex polyhedron, and the Brun-Minkowski inequality implies this then. So I'm skipping details here. One nice source is Lars Ofersto's book on regular polyhedra. There it is derived. It also explains why edge curvature is a natural quantity to take. It is a variant of Kramers integral, of the proper Kramers integral or intrinsic volume, if you like. It's not the proper intrinsic volume. There is a difference here, and that tangent is responsible for that. But it's related to this Steiner Kramers integral thing. Nevertheless, a very nice inequality holds. When you square the surface volume of your polyhedron, that's at least as large, 3 times the volume times the edge curvature. Now, in all cases, it will be more convenient to turn to inner dihedral angles. These are outer exterior angles of normal vectors, but there is an inner dihedral angle assigned to each edge, which are labeled by beta of sub e. So the sum of these two is pi. So this is known, that the sum, of course, easy to see, that the when you add these together, you get pi. So it will be more convenient to use the inner dihedral angles in the definition of the edge curvature, although this is not the traditional way of doing it. Nevertheless, in our case, we have an extra luck. The volume of each cell is at least 1/3 times the surface area. So this inequality, together with this one here, implies this. So I can substitute 1/3 times surface area for the volume here, and then simplify by surface area and get this, that surface area of a cell is at least this quantity, which is the edge curvature of the convex polyhedron. So this is an inequality which we have for each convex cell in our system. Again, surface area is bounded below by the edge curvature of the convex polyhedron, and this was possible because each cell contains a unit ball. Then this is one component. Then there is a little bit of geometry here, which elementary one, which we can get together in a proper form. So the goal is to get to this inequality down here, which is very natural to have. So what we want to generate a lower bound for the total surface area. So we will be dealing with overall sums of edge curvatures. Each edge curvature has this cotangent term here, and so we will collect cotangent terms around edges. Each edge is a meeting point of some cells, and their dihedral angles meet together, and those dihedral angles we collect together, and then the proper partial sum we want to estimate from below. So that's what's happening here in the last row. We collect it together in a dihedral angles, meeting along an edge of our tiling, and we want to squeeze out that this inequality holds. So what I'm trying to say is this, and here's perhaps a little picture that I could insert here, that we take some cells meeting along it's very hard to draw, of course, reasonable good picture here, but what I'm trying to say that when we pick an edge in our tiling, like the one here, we will see some cells meeting there. In this picture, I was trying to say that there are three tetrahedra meeting along along this reddish edge in three space, so three dihedral angles get together, and their sum is 2 pi. But there are other cases which one has to deal with, because it can also happen that when I pick an edge inside the cube, then along that edge at least 3 cells meet. But if I pick my edge on the boundary of the cube, which is also possible to take in general, so if my edge is somewhere on the face of a cube, then here typically fewer cells meet, maybe only 2. And if an edge is on the edge of the cube, then maybe only 1 cell hits that edge. So there are these natural subcases to distinguish. So when I pick my edge of some length, then there are some cells meeting there, either at least 1 or at least 2, at least 3, depending on where we are in our tiling. So in each of these cases, the sum of the dihedral angles is either pi over 2 or pi or 2 pi. So the very first case is when the chosen edge is on an edge of the big cube. There, when you add together the dihedral angles in the dihedral angles of the cells, you get only pi over 2. Nevertheless, in each of these cases, we know that the angles, individual angles here, which enter their half, is at most pi over 2. So cotangent is convex over the interval 0, pi over 2. So we use the convexity of the cotangent, and that's how we derive this inequality. this 1 over square root of 3 is here because that's coming from the weak sort of setup here, that in general, if I take an edge inside my big cube, then I cannot say more, only there that 3 cells meet along that edge. And so really we do not get k here. K means the number of cells meeting along the edge. Only 1 over square root 3 times k. So then what we do, we sum up, well, maybe I go back here. We sum up these edge curvatures for each cell and then regroup the terms such that we group those terms together which share a partial edge in common. And then we apply this inequality. And each time when we make this group, the actual k that enters here means the number of cells along that edge. And therefore, after all, this rearrangement is the same as this sum here, where you take the total lengths of edge lengths of each individual cell and sum them together. So overall, the inequality that we derived on this second page here for the cotangents of the half of the inner dihedral angles leads to this term. This part also coming from Kerr's paper here. It's a very nice, great result of Bezukhovich and Eggleston, that if you have a convex polyhedron containing a unit ball, then the total edge length is always at least 24, minimum being the unit cube circumscribed the unit ball. So that explains this last inequality. So then when we do substitute this here, then we just get 24 over square root of 3. So this is the compact part of the theorem that we wanted to prove. And the second part is somehow to get to this general situation which I have been indicating somewhere earlier, that this is the ideal thing when the cells of the balls which lie in the big cube actually generate a tiling for the entire cube. But this we don't have, so one has to work for that here. This part is basically relying on three different things. One is that when I take my sequence of, because we are shooting for lin-inf, so we will take a sequence of big cubes such that their edge lengths tend to infinity, so an arbitrary sequence of larger cubes. And for each cube, we write out our average surface area. And, the boundary effect is the troublemaker, but there is one fact that is easy to derive, that the number of cells which hit the boundary of a big cube is negligible compared to the number of cells which are hit by the big cube. This is one easy thing which one can get because we are in Euclidean space. This were not true in hyperbolic and spherical. The other fact which enters here, the middle part of this thing here is a kind of revisiting the proof that I have just outlined for the compact case. One needs to refine some arguments here in the middle part. And in order to get to an inequality, which I will show here. So in the middle part here, we try to generate an inequality of the following sort. We have our big cube C sub L of edge length L. It contains some unit balls. So the left side and the right side has the same denominator, the number of unit balls which are in the big cell. However, the numerators are different. On the left, we have the sum of the surface areas of the traces of the cells with respect to big cube. And here we just add together 24 over square root of 3 for each unit ball. Unfortunately, if I neglect these error terms, this inequality doesn't hold. So the goal is to create an inequality where I do have error terms, but those error terms are negligible. And that's what this middle part does, that we create error terms here for this inequality. Here you see the cardinality of those cells which hit the boundary of the big cube. We already know, and this is what I mentioned first, that this is negligible to the cardinality of those unit balls which are in the big cell. And moreover, there are two quantities here, A and E, which both naturally enter due to the assumption that we have chosen normal timings. Normal timings, as we mentioned right at the beginning, have an upper bound for the diameters of the cells, and each cell contains a unit ball, so therefore, there's an upper bound for the surface area of the cells, not only for the diameters, but also for the surface area, as well as there is an upper bound for the total edge length. Both enter here, and both of them are rather elementary to derive. For instance, when you want to derive that in case of a normal tiling, there is an upper bound for the total edge length, you perhaps just simply do the following. So when you look at a cell, first you notice that there is an upper bound for the number of faces, because of the natural thing that if I have a cell and certain number of faces, then the number of neighbors is at least that many as the number of faces. So if we would not have an upper bound on the number of faces, that would mean that we have average large number of neighbors around a cell, but each cell contains a unit ball, and each cell has an upper bound for the diameter, so that really cannot happen. So once we have an upper bound on the face number, we obviously have an upper bound on the edge number due to the Euler formula, and then once you have an upper bound on the edge number, each edge has length at most the diameter of the cell. So then there is an upper bound on the total edge length. So that's also here as a fact. So as soon as we have an inequality like this with these error terms, then we derive the desired thing, because we just let all this to act for our sequence of increasing sequence of big cubes. And then we get that although this is an arbitrary sequence of cubes, the lim-inf should be at least 24 over square root of 3. So I omitted the middle part where we do this technicality, they actually work out the error terms, but the main things I went through. Unfortunately, in this proof, convexity plays an essential role right from the beginning, in particular because of the Born-Minkowski consequence that we put down there for convex polyhedra. So if polyhedra are not convex, then that inequality, unfortunately, is not true. Maybe with some error terms, but that's hanging in the air. I don't know too much about that direction. So I stop here. Thank you very much. The two-dimensional case is even simpler, because when you look at the two-dimensional problem, the form problem, for instance, so we can shoot immediately for the form problem in two-space. So the cells are, of course, measurable along with the boundaries, so we assume that. So when you look at the boundary of a cell, and you see something like this, it's not good, because clearly, surface area there would mean that shortening the perimeter. So it immediately means that the cells have to be polygonal cells, each containing a unit disk. Plus, it has to be convex, yes, because if a cell will have an obtuse angle like this, then again we can shorten this without interfering with the unit disk in the cells. So the cells have to be convex polygons. Unfortunately, this argument to start working in three space. Yes, the minimal surfaces business is very tricky. That does not allow to have such a simple argument. However, in the plane, this is fine. That is fine. So we end up with a convex tiling, convex polygons, each containing a unit disk. And then what we do is the following. So we have a convex polygon with a unit disk, certain number of sides we have here. Clearly, there is the smallest area polygon with that many number of sides. So we take that regular convex polygon with that many sides, circumscribe the unit disk. And we know, this is also well known, that this sequence, I mean, these polygons, minimal area polygons, which are regular, form a convex sequence with respect to n. And the average side number is at most 6. So putting these together, the average, due to Euler formula, the average side number is at most 6. And the convexity of this special sequence of minimal area is true for parameter as well, that's convex, implies that the regular hexagon tiling is the best.
I mean, the scale of polygon form, right?
It's a different, of different nature, because there the volume is fixed, area is fixed. Each cell must have the same area, whereas in our case, each cell contains a unit disk, which is a big help here in the Euclidean case. It makes the problem much easier. Immediately you can get. But in his case, in the case of a Hanekom conjecture, he had to deal with all kind of tricky issues there, due to the fact that the area of each cell was fixed one, and the average parameter had to be minimized. That's what I mentioned at the very beginning, perhaps. Sorry, because here you see this slide is the extension of my question to forms. So if you drop convexity, this is Kelvin, yeah? This is variant of Kelvin, but it is different from Kelvin. Already we see that in the plane is somehow suddenly much easier than Kelvin. Unfortunately, three space doesn't look so, but to me the real surprising thing is that even if we dropped convexity, we could not do much better than the rhombic dodecahedral so far. You know, I asked this. When he was here, I have not had yet this manuscript written out fully, but I did talk to him about this. You know, I can quote him, but it's maybe not fair. He said the conjecture seems plausible, reasonable to him. So, but we may not have the same opinion, so it is not well tested yet to say that, well, that conjecture that the average surface area is minimal for the rhombic dodecahedron would be a reasonable conjecture to put forward. I did not put down there as a conjecture. I put it there as proof or disproof, so I'm not convinced. Although he did say that it's reasonable to bring up that as a conjecture. But just to indicate, let me step back a little bit, just to indicate what kind of difficulty we have here. I don't know whether I mentioned it here or no, probably it's not on the slide. But let me put forward this question. It's also open, although much much simpler than the question that is here. let's restrict ourselves to the following normal tiling. Parallelohedra are convex polyhedra who tie space by translates. So there are five types of different parallelohedra. So the combinatorial class is more. And the question here is, which parallelohedron has the minimum surface area containing a unit ball? I don't know. It is, despite the fact that it is a very restricted class of convex polyhedra, these are monohedral tilings, just single cells, same-looking single cells. They tie space by translation. We each contains a unit ball, and I don't know which one has the smallest surface area. And I circulated this question, and there are different type of ideas how to handle this, but so far no real confirmation that the rhombic dodecahedron would be the smallest surface area. Only I have claims that locally it's best, but not globally yet. And this is because it's not really a convex optimization question. Yeah, because that's another story that Delaunay had this conjecture that every parallelohedron is an affine image of a Voronoi cell, okay, which is checked up to dimension 5. So, Voronoi conjecture. Thank you very much. Yeah, Voronoi conjecture. And Delaunay just proves in special cases. Yeah, thank you. So, yes, in 3 space, yes, so we know that.
Okay.